Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Joe Heschmeyer here with us this hour. The number 888-318-7884. You can ask him anything you'd like to ask about the Catholic faith. And you don't have to be Catholic to call. I don't think I emphasized that enough last hour when Trent was on, that everybody's welcome. You can be not Catholic. You can be Catholic. You can be on your way to being Catholic. You can even be on your way out of the Catholic Church. We will try to talk you back in, but you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer, apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of this popular book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, and many other books, and the proprietor of Shameless Popery, which just keeps getting more and more popular. Welcome, Joe Heschmeyer.
Thanks. It's so good to be here.
Shameless Popery, you can find at shamelesspopery.com, right?
You can find the blog at shamelesspopery.com.
Oh, I always do
that.
You go
to shamelessjoe.com.
Shamelessjoe.com.
You can find the audio. Honestly, it's kind of my fault for not putting everything in one very convenient location.
It is,
but
really.
I've got a lot of, yeah, I know.
But if you have little
babies.
I've
got stuff
at home
in text, audio, and video format. if you go to YouTube and look up Shameless Popery, I have it was a weekly podcast. It's now twice weekly, which I'm really grateful for the people like Thomas who work behind the scenes to make it possible for me to be able to produce that much stuff and have it look decent and sound decent. So I do a short one on Tuesdays and a long one on Thursdays.
We need to have a different name for Thomas, like, because everybody knows Thomas the TikTok engineer. So it
has, yeah, he has Thomas to be like W, I guess we could say, like,
the other Thomas.
Good Thomas?
No, Thomas the TikTok engineer is a good Thomas. Maybe we should say normal Thomas. And Thomas,
yeah, there
the TikTok engine.
Oh, now
his Thomas's mother's going to call me now. Thomas's mother listens to the show, and I can't. She's a good mom. She's his advocate. Now I'm in trouble. 888-318-788. Oh, look at this. The first call is Thomas in Arlington, Massachusetts. All right, 888-318-7884. I don't know. It's a big day of Thomas's around here. Thomas in Arlington, Massachusetts, listening on our website, Catholic.com. You are El Primero this hour. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
I was wondering if this statement seems to strike Joe as true from a Catholic perspective. The claim that since animals, I'm trying to think of a good way to address the problem of animal suffering, and I think this might be a good way to do it. I want to see what Joe thinks. If animals, every single animal, as far as we know, has a finite destiny, but human beings have a infinite destiny, right? If we go to heaven or hell. So doesn't that mean that each human being, individual human being, has more value than the collection of every single animal that's ever lived? And if that's the case, doesn't it kind of raise the burden of proof for the atheist that he needs to show that the animal suffering needs to be so evil that it can't even do any good for one specific person? Like, all we have to show as Catholics is that God is able to bring about, through the evil of animal suffering, say the one soul going to heaven, and that infinite good outweighs the finite evil of all the animal suffering that's ever existed. I just wanted to see what you thought on that.
I think that the beginning to that about the relative value of human and animal suffering, or human and animal life, is maybe the way to frame it. If you're familiar with, like, the trolley experiment, if you have a dog on one track and a human on the other, and one of them is going to die, well, you'd better choose the dog. You know, or to take, like, a more concrete example, if you're driving and a kid runs into the road and you can swerve and hit a dog instead, you should do that. And you should, even if it's two dogs. In fact, there's no number of dogs where you say, better to hit the kid. That this is the difference between human and animal life. Now, we want to be careful in saying this, that we don't say that animal life is of no value. It just doesn't carry the same sacredness or infinite value by comparison that a human life carries. So we shouldn't needlessly inflict suffering upon animals. We shouldn't needlessly cause animals to suffer. You know, the if you've got a pet and it's in a state of agonizing suffering, it's cruel to prolong its life unnaturally in a way that's just going to lead to it suffering for longer and longer. You need to just put the animal to sleep. But the reason you can do something like put the animal to sleep is actually precisely because it doesn't have the same dignity of a human life. And so its suffering doesn't have the same value. If your grandma is suffering, you don't just euthanize her. You don't just put her to sleep the way you do an animal. That we treat humans and animals both in life and in suffering very differently because we recognize, and in fact, even many atheists recognize a tremendous difference in the value. So I would say, given that, that you're right, that therefore, one part of the answer to the problem of animal suffering may be that animal suffering has an important role to play in reference to human salvation. Now, what that role looks like is going to be a very hotly debated sort of issue. But if taking care of animals is helpful, if it helps lead us to heaven, then that's a pretty concrete kind of case where, yeah, the suffering is not pointless.
That's really helpful. Would you say that it's correct to say that all the animals that have ever existed, like their value can't add up to the infinite value of even one human being? Do you think that part
yeah,
of what I said is
I would actually press anyone who denied that to say, like, how many dogs
right.
is a human life worth? You know, if you could save seven dogs by murdering an innocent person, would you do it? And if someone says yes, they reveal themselves to have a really disturbing moral framework. And you will find people who will say, you know, yes. Following a kind of utilitarian logic that we give a certain weight to animal suffering vis-a-vis human suffering. But those are totally made up kind of values. So, you know, if you're familiar with the work of somebody like Peter Singer, this is the idea that we should do the thing that causes the greatest happiness and eliminates the most suffering. But then you have to weigh, like, well, are we looking at human suffering, animal suffering, or both? And if we're looking at both, what's the ratio of unhappy dogs to unhappy people? And it leads to these really bizarre kind of results.
Thank you. I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for getting us started today with your question, Thomas. The number is 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. And we've got time before we have to take the first break, so I think I'll go to Marion in Lindsay, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Marion, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yes, I had a question on one of the political parties has for their platform, they have that they want reproductive rights. Doesn't everybody already have those rights to reproduce?
Yeah, well, I think reproductive rights is a euphemism and a misnomer. What they actually mean is they want to make it legal to kill small members of the human species. But you can't just say that because that sounds pretty dastardly. So you have to cloak it in the language of reproductive rights. But let's be really clear. So the book, The Biology of Reproduction, just to give one example, this is Fusco and Minelli. It's a classic kind of biological textbook. You can find any number of textbooks that say the same thing. Explain, and I'm going to quote them here. In biology, reproduction is often defined as the process by which new individuals are produced from pre-existing individuals. Now, please understand, biologically, this happens at the moment when sperm and egg meet. You have a new genetically distinct human organism. In fact, this becomes really clear with the case of something like IVF, in vitro fertilization, where they fertilize the egg in a lab. Well, there you have human reproduction occurring in this very unnatural way, but you clearly have a genetically distinct human organism that exists outside of the mother in this case. You cannot say that's part of the mom because it's not part of the mom. It's not part of the dad. It's one gamete from the mom, one gamete from the dad, together forming a new human person, which is, by the way, the same thing you are, right? Like, you are half your mother's and half your father's DNA, but that doesn't mean you're her body or his body. So all that's to say, reproduction has already occurred at the moment of pregnancy, that once you're pregnant, reproduction, the creation of new life, is actually done. Now, we sometimes speak in a loose way of reproduction going up to birth, but scientifically speaking, biologically speaking, reproduction has already occurred. So what people want to control is not really reproduction, unless they're talking about birth control. What they want to control is ending a life once it's been created. But because they don't want to say that directly, they cloak it under the scientifically inaccurate description of reproductive rights.
Marion, I'm going to leave that there and hope that that was helpful to you. We have to take a quick break now. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. You can find his work at shamelessjoe.com. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
There is tremendous power in prayer, because when we acknowledge that we don't have the power, but God does, things then begin to move for our good. Remember Matthew 19:26. But Jesus looked at them and said to them, "With men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible." Now that's power.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, whether you are Catholic or not, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Going to Kaylee in Oklahoma, listening on 109.9 FM. Kaylee, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe. No, Kaylee? I think I pushed the right button. Did I push the right button? Hang on. All right, I tell you what, Kaylee, if you're there, we'll come back to you. We like our callers. We want to come back to you, so just hang on. But in the meantime, I'll go down to Houston, Texas, where Oscar is listening on 1430 AM. Oscar, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, Cy and Joe. My question is on purgatory and indulgences. Okay. I've heard some apologists explain purgatory like it's a detachment from, like, it's a cleansing of your attachment to sin. Mm-hmm. Other apologists have explained it as it's like if you break a window and then you're grounded for, you know, 2 weeks, and that's when you fulfill your, I guess, your penance. And both of those explanations seem to involve the person a lot. Like, either I'm atoning for it in purgatory, or in terms of cleansing, I'm like getting ready for heaven. But when it comes to an indulgence, at least, like, if a person applies an indulgence to you, like, you're not really doing any of that stuff. Like, you're not really growing in holiness, which is what the indulgence for yourself would be. And so my question, I guess, would be like, it sounds like it's some sort of like substitutionary satisfaction. An indulgence. So I guess, could Joe explain purgatory in view of this, of like what an indulgence is in terms, you know, of like that substitutionary part of the indulgence?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I want to introduce you to a dynamic within the New Testament that I think we as Westerners have a lot of trouble with, which is that salvation itself is never entirely individualistic. And this is why we evangelize, by the way. This is also why we pray for other people. It's why, you know, we try to turn others away from their sin, that our actions can help save other people. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 14, St. Paul talks about this in the context of marriage, saying that the unbelieving husband is consecrated through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is consecrated through her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. So he doesn't explain it, right? He just kind of throws that out as one verse. And there's obviously a rich theology behind that, that you interceding for the people in your life who aren't saved even can help bring them to salvation in some way. And seemingly the some way is God giving them special graces. Now, if that's true for something as big as whether someone goes to heaven or hell, then it certainly follows logically that this is true for the smaller things as well. That if someone's going through a spiritual purification, it can be expedited. It can be, you know, the road of purification can be made smoother in some way or faster in some way by virtue of our intercession and our prayers. I would add here the paralytic man whose friends bring him to Christ. We're told in the text that Jesus sees their faith, meaning the friends, and says to the man, your sins are forgiven. So we should take very seriously that we can do things on behalf of other people for their spiritual upbuilding that aren't a simple, you know, me growing by my own effort in the spiritual life sort of equation. No, God, by grace, does all sorts of things, and we can help to win those things for one another through our prayers, through our sufferings, through our good actions.
Okay. Can I add one more question?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Go on. Sorry.
No, that's all right. Please, continue.
I thought you were finished. I'm so sorry. What?
You go ahead with your question, Oscar.
I was going to add with baptism, like mm-hmm. when you're baptized, I've heard it said that if you die right after baptism, you don't go through purgatory. But then I would imagine people who get baptized still have attachments to sin deep down. And like, so what is the purpose of purgatory then? If it's not just for...
Uh-huh. Right. So the point of purgatory is to make us like God. So nothing impure is going to see God. And so those of us who post-baptismally continue to sin, even venially, we have places in our life that aren't fit to be in the presence of God. That there are moments in your life, moments perhaps even in your day, where if you were called before the throne of judgment at that very moment, you would be pretty ashamed. You know, you spoke to a person in a way that wasn't fit for how you should treat another person. Any number of things, right? And so in those things, even when they don't threaten your salvation, they are still impurities that need to be purified. Now, there's different ways that they can be purified. Purgatory is the name we give for the process of purification. But through the prayers and intercession of one another, we hope to speed that along and ease that along.
You know what? I think I'm going to actually leave that there and go on to the next one, Oscar. I'm just realizing as you two are talking that every line is full and they just fill up 1 second after they get empty. So I hope that was helpful. Oscar, call back another time if there's more help you need on that one. I'm going to go to Jacob in Michigan. Jacob, thank you very much for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, so this is kind of a long one, but I think all of it's important, and I'll try to be as quick as possible. So I called him last Thursday.
Jacob, I might limit you on that because it's not an unlimited amount of time till the break. So do try to just ask the question and give Joe a chance to answer.
I don't know. Can I postpone it until as the next one and let somebody else go?
It really needs to be that long, Jacob? There's not a short version of it?
I think so. It's like the break's at 19:20, so I don't think I'm going to be able to confess that. Easily.
Okay, hang on, and we'll come back to you, Jacob. We're going to get back to Stephen in Jackson, Mississippi, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Stephen, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
I think this actually links up well with the previous question, because it's all about pain and suffering. And my question is how I understand that Christ's suffering on the cross was beneficial because he was doing it for us. I understand how suffering that eradicates sin in my life is beneficial because it eradicates sin in my life. But there seems to be in the Catholic conception a benefit to suffering as suffering. Like if we suffer, you know, we subject ourselves to things like, you know, ascetical practices and things that seem to have the only purpose be for us to undergo some sort of even minor suffering. How is that beneficial? How is that valuable?
Yeah, so let's start with Colossians 1, verse 24, because I think this is a really good place to begin, where St. Paul says, "Now I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake, and in my flesh I complete what is lacking in Christ's affliction for the sake of his body that is the church." So, yeah, you're right. There is this dimension in which when suffering comes, we can either just lament it because it hurts, or we can say this is an invitation to enter into the cross with Jesus Christ. At the heart of this is this idea that when Jesus comes, he doesn't die on the cross to take away the cross. He dies on the cross to give our crosses meaning. Like, he doesn't say, abandon your cross and follow me because I've died in your place. He instead says, take up your cross and follow me. Right? So this is the idea that we are going to have the cross either way. You're going to have sufferings in your life. And Jesus does not eliminate suffering from your life. He does not promise to do that. And he just doesn't. What he does do is he gives your cross meaning. Because just as through his suffering and death, born out of love, salvation comes to the world. So when we bear suffering in love, when we do this in love for other people, we are helping in this mysterious way in the redemption of the world. How? Well, precisely through obedient, loving submission in the face of suffering. This is what it means to kind of offer this up. We make a sacrificial offering in our bodies. So if you take Romans 12, verse 1, St. Paul says spiritual worship is bodily worship. Spiritual worship for Christians is offering things up in your body. So every time you suffer for someone else out of love, when you allow yourself to be inconvenienced, everything from allowing the other person to drive slowly in front of you in traffic without honking at them to childbirth, all of those things are times in which you allow yourself to be inconvenienced all the way up to put through profound suffering out of love for your neighbor, out of love for someone else. When you unite that to Jesus's perfect act of self-gift on the cross, this has meaning and value. If you want a really good document on this, Salvifici Doloris from 1984 is St. John Paul II's apostolic letter on this topic. And it's entirely on this theme of salvific suffering. That's what the title means.
Okay, Stephen?
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm still unsure about how, like, self-selected suffering that seems to be arbitrary is beneficial. Like, I get suffering
from something
other people,
like fasting, where you allow yourself voluntarily to be inconvenienced for some cause, whether that cause is I want to grow my relationship with God, whether that cause is I've got this offering, you know, someone else. You know, we had my brother-in-law was interviewing for a job, and so we all gave up ice cream, or gave up sweets. In my case, it was ice cream for like the week, where we just didn't have any, no like sugar, no desserts, no treats, just for his sake. And he got the job. But it was this idea that you can allow yourself to be inconvenienced for someone else. And God will reward this even when you're choosing some minor suffering. But when you're choosing it, in a lot of ways, this is preparation for the sufferings that are going to come along that you don't choose. And I think that's a spiritual discipline we have to be very mindful of, that we can choose some of the sufferings in our life. When you pray, when you fast, when you mortify your body in any way, you are allowing yourself to be sort of disciplined for the sake of the kingdom, for the sake of growth and holiness, and for some good cause for your neighbor, perhaps. But this is also a preparation for all of the sufferings and inconveniences that are going to come your way that you didn't choose and aren't the ones that you might want. You know, so if you think about something like Lent, where we give things up, we're not required to do that. It's a good spiritual practice, as long as we recognize that the real battle is often not the things we've chosen to give up, but the things that God has chosen to make us give up. Maybe our time, maybe our sleep, maybe, you know, whatever it is that we were valuing. You've got a free evening and then a neighbor comes over and wants to talk. Okay, that's a sacrifice you've been invited into. But if you get in the habit of voluntarily making sacrifices and allowing yourself to undergo mild suffering for the sake of your neighbor, well, you're going to be much more likely to handle that well when those moments come.
Stephen, thank you very much for the call. I don't like to ever interrupt or correct something that the apologist said, but I do. I think this is serious. Joe might have implied that it's not grave matter to drive slowly in the fast lane, but that is that is grave matter. If you drive slowly in the fast lane, you need to confess that.
You are inflicting suffering upon your neighbor at that
that's
point.
That's a horrible, that horrible like a sin. And I just didn't want anyone to think, oh, Joe was saying it's no big deal, Joe. You know, you don't want to lead people into sin.
Of course not.
No.
Don't very slowly go into sin.
No. Get out of the fast lane. The use of it is in the name. Okay.
The people who need to hear this don't know about what a fast lane is. They just think it's the left turn lane.
I guess so. You know, I don't want to have bad thoughts about them. I just want to help them morally. I want to protect them from the moral error of driving.
This is a loving honk of rebuking your neighbor.
That's right. I'm there for you.
Correcting the ignorant.
Yes, right. Hunter in Missouri watching on YouTube. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey there, Joe. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for you about some Old Testament historicity and how it intersects with the concept of biblical inerrancy. Specifically, like the book of Joshua. So I recently discovered that apparently a great many Old Testament scholars think that some or maybe even all of the events detailed in the book of Joshua never actually happened, like the conquests of Jericho or Ai. And they say that the archaeological record doesn't line up with the timeline in the book of Joshua, that the cities mentioned in it weren't occupied at the times detailed in Joshua. I'm no expert in this stuff, so I guess my question is, like, let's assume for the sake of argument that those criticisms are correct, that those events did not happen. Would that, like, destroy biblical inerrancy? Are we obliged to believe, in opposition to those scholars, that those things actually did happen? Or do you think that the author of Joshua intended to do something?
You got to wait till the break. We'll get the answer after this. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Stephen, I'm sorry about that. Your question went right up to the break, but I wanted to see if we could get the whole question in. Did you feel like that Joe's got your question
historicity of the
I'm talking to
book
Hunter.
Of Joshua,
I apologize. Hunter, on the historicity of the book of Joshua. You got everything
that's
in you
right,
want?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Joe.
I think so.
Okay, great. So in 1 Samuel chapter 18, after David kills Goliath, in verse 7, the women sing a song of rejoicing. And the song is, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens thousands, or tens of thousands, we might say. And at this time, how many people has David literally killed? One, Goliath. And so the women aren't lying, but they are being intentionally hyperbolic in describing a historical event. And Saul is annoyed by this, not because, oh, you got the number wrong, but because he understands that they're ascribing more greatness to David than to him. You can read all about that in 1 Samuel 18. So likewise, when we're reading the book of Joshua, This is a historical account that nevertheless uses, at times, hyperbolic language. And so you will find in one place where a tribe is, like, utterly obliterated, and then you'll hear from them again a few chapters later. And it's like, well, if they were literally, you know, wiped off the face of the earth or something, you wouldn't hear from them ever again. And so in the same way that, you know, if you're talking sports, we might say, you know, the Chiefs have destroyed the Broncos, like, 18 of the last 19 times or whatever that stat is. We don't literally mean that they had to completely restart their team that many times. We're using a well-known hyperbolic expression. And both the Old and New Testament have these kind of hyperbolic expressions. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. That's hyperbole. Don't literally do that. If you want to be my disciples, you have to hate your father and mother. That's hyperbole, right? Like, in both the Old and New Testament, there are all of these, what we call semitism, these Hebrew expressions that are often intentionally hyperbolic and were understood that way by the readers. But because we take the view that literal means non-hyperbolic, that we often misunderstand that the literal meaning of Scripture might be intentionally exaggerating something. Is that helpful? So we can talk about this being historical while also leaving in view that some of the descriptions appear to be intentionally exaggerated.
Right. No, yes, that makes sense. I just wondered if it seems like in some ways the it might be described closer to like the late Bronze Age as opposed to like more middle Bronze Age. I'm wondering if maybe the author of Joshua drew on more recent events and applied them to earlier events, not in like a lying way, but that in accordance with an accepted kind of literary genre of the time to
I'm to very tell, skeptical to of those arguments. Story. And okay. The reason yeah, I'm skeptical yeah, of those arguments what's is allowed. They're often based on really weak evidence. So a lot of the kind of skeptical biblical arguments are largely arguments from silence, that we don't have a ton of writings from the period in which the biblical texts are apparently from. And so we're guessing about a lot of the details here. Or, oh, we don't have the archaeological evidence to show that this thing happened, but there are probably a great many events we don't have the archaeological evidence for, because the archaeological evidence is in many cases inconclusive. I heard a stat somewhere that something like 98% of the written papyrus is estimated to have been lost. So there's a whole world of written documents, archaeological evidence, lived experience, and the like that we today just do not have access to, except in this very fleeting kind of tip of the iceberg that we get from ancient documents, from the limited archaeological digs that we've done, and everything else. And so to make any kind of sweeping declaration on the basis of the very tiny bit of information we have about what was and wasn't possible for, you know, the period of the time of Joshua, for instance, I take all of those arguments with just tremendous grains of salt. Not saying none of them could be right, but I'd have to see some pretty good evidence before I start entertaining that as like a serious contender rather than just kind of idle scholarly speculation.
Thanks, Hunter. Thanks very much for that one. I always think about I think it's the Pool of Siloam on that one, where the scholars of the 19th century, clearly, John, this is just a made-up story because there is no Pool of Siloam. And then the archaeologists discover the Pool of Siloam, and it's exactly how John described it.
I mean, the entire city of Troy. Think about the Trojan War.
Oh, yeah, right.
For a long time, scholars didn't think the Trojan War existed. Like, an entire war had just been made up for literary reasons, and then they discovered the ruins of the city of Troy. So that's what I mean. Like, anytime people are saying, well, archaeologically, we've proven this thing doesn't exist because we haven't found it. It's like, that is a very weak argument, because there's all sorts of things we haven't found that we may one day find.
Hunter, thanks very much. Joe, I'm going to ask you to summarize Jacob, because Jacob said, he had a long question to ask. And at the break, we were able to get clarity on what he's looking for. So, and you said you understood what he was asking.
Yeah, Jacob, why don't I put the question to you and you can confirm that I'm understanding you correctly. So it sounds like you called in last week with a question about how to confess repeated sins, and you were told about number and kind. So as Canon 988 says, a member of the Christian faithful is obliged to confess in kind and number all grave sins committed after baptism and not yet remitted directly through the keys of the church, nor acknowledged in individual confession, of which the person has knowledge after diligent examination of conscience. So if you've stolen five cars, that's a different thing than if you've stolen one or if you've stolen 1,000. And the priest hearing your confession should have some sense of, is this a one-time sin? Is this a habitual sin? How often have you fallen into this sin since your last confession? And so then, if I'm understanding your question correctly, is what if you confess the number you believe is true, and then after further diligent examination, you realize maybe your number was off? Is that a fair read of your question?
I didn't hear if that was yes or no, Jacob. I'm sorry. I just didn't hear it.
Yeah, yes.
Yes, it is. Okay, okay, Joe, go ahead.
You do not need to worry about that at all. You have not intentionally held anything back in confession. You have made a diligent examination of conscience. You have, to the best of your ability, confessed number and kind. If you say, I lied 50 times and it was actually 51, God's going to forgive you all 51. You're not intentionally withholding anything, and you're not being negligent. So I would warn against, I don't know your own state. I don't know if you suffer from either OCD or scrupulosity, but I would not be fixating on, in my last confession, did I get the number just right? Because that is not the kind of thing God cares about. And that is what I mean is you're not intentionally holding any sins back from him. And all of your sins together are not even an iota of his mercy in terms of their weight and value. So trust in the greatness of the mercy of God, no matter how large your sins are, and don't worry if your estimate wasn't, you know, precise to the nearest decimal place.
Jacob, I hope that was helpful to you, and I appreciate the calls. I'd love to send you a copy of Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. If you'd like it, just hang on and give us an address. Give an address that we can send it to Edgar, and we'll send it either to that address or to the state of Indiana, one of those two. Just hang on, and let's see. We're going now to Allison in Canada. Our first Canada, is our first Canada call today, listening on Catholic.com. Allison, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi. So my question is that my son is almost 3 and he really loves going to church, and he's heard me and my husband talk a lot about how Jesus is really present at church. Mm-hmm. And while he's excited to see Jesus there, he gets really confused when we go to church and there's no man there who looks like Jesus.
Yes.
So he'll sometimes say, like, Jesus was gone, or Jesus was taking a nap. And I was
what a
just
beautiful
wondering,
I love your son already.
I was just wondering if you had any ideas for how I could help explain, like, the real presence of Jesus to him.
Yeah. So if you stay on the line, I'm going to make sure you get a copy of my book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. In there, I give an example from a little girl who was preparing for First Communion. And when the priest asked her understanding of the real presence, she gave this delightfully clear example. Oh, I'm sorry. I did just find out because you're in Canada, we can't send
you a physical copy.
We'll send you at least a PDF.
Well, yeah, we'll get it way or another.
We'll get you a version somehow. I forgot Canada's technically a different country now.
I don't think it's a technicality, Joe. It's actually a different country. Or can we take credit for their medals at the Olympics? Because
I haven't gotten over the War of 1812 yet. Anyway,
which of us has, Joe?
Amen.
Just hang on. We'll get it to you one way or another, Allison.
In that book, I give an example of a young girl who asked about the real presence, looks at the crucifix and says, the crucifix looks like Jesus, but isn't really. The Eucharist doesn't look like Jesus, but really is. And I think that is a beautifully simple and clear understanding of the doctrine of the real presence. And I don't know. I don't know your 2-year-old. How do you think he would receive something like that? Would that make sense? Does he understand the idea of real versus pretend?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd be curious as to how he takes it. I'm happy to kind of keep that conversation going. And it sounds like you're doing a great job as a mom, so I want to encourage you in that, too. My sister, some years ago, when one of my nieces was young, was trying to explain the Eucharist to her kids, and she thought she'd kind of gotten it, And then she took her, I think, 2-year-old up, you know, was carrying her at communion. And the 2-year-old reaches out her hand and says, "Can I have one, Jesus?" And so she knew they were going up to receive Jesus. She just thought that meant they were going up to receive food from Jesus.
Oh, so she thought the priest was Jesus.
She thought the priest was Jesus. I mean, in persona Christi, she was in wrong ballpark. In some endearing sort of ways. So,
Allison, this is
say,
one.
Be patient with the 2-year-old.
Yeah, but also call back and tell us how it went. This is yes, one I'd like please. To hear about how the that how this went and when Joe's on again. But don't worry, Canada is apparently its own country, but we'll still send you the book one way or another. We'll get it to you. So give an address to Edgar, and we'll find out some way to get it up there. I know the mail goes to Canada. I know you can mail things to Canada. I don't know why we're limited in that regard. We better take a break. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You know, I have never seen women who want to be equal absolutely degrading themselves. And yet the media degrades your nature, your beauty as a woman, your goodness. Let us pray at some point our dear Lord touches their hearts.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're awful glad you're here. Thanks for spending the time with us. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest this hour, and it's Ask Me Anything. And we're going now to Vancouver, Washington, where Teresa is listening on KBVM radio. Teresa, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about the Holy Eucharist in reception at Mass. There's been teachings where it has been kneeling in the mouth, and then more recently the Church has said you have the option to receive in the hand. And then some of the saints' readings I've seen indicate that that is not correct, and it is not respectful of the Holy Eucharist. So,
what saint readings are you talking about there?
I can't recall. I know Mother Teresa was very sad about it. I know that.
I think that's actually a fake Mother Teresa quote. If it's the one that I think you might be referring to, there's plenty of pictures of Mother Teresa receiving communion standing and in the hand. And I've seen, quotes attributed to Mother Teresa circulating that go contrary to that, that can't be traced to any of her actual writings.
Well, also, it seems as though exorcist Chad Ripperger had commented about
that might be true.
If the only place you could receive it is in the mouth, because when you're baptized, or at least originally, that there was some sort of blessing or chrism or holy water, something that allowed your mouth to receive where the hand has not been. So
That's not a real thing either. I haven't heard the original thing, so I don't want to, you know, attack Father Ripperger if, you know, maybe I'm misunderstanding what it is he's saying. But the early Christians received in the hand. Now, it sounds like we might agree on our preferred posture. I find it easier prayerfully to receive kneeling on the tongue, and that's what my parish does. But I can't say that it's sinful or something like this that the church permits either way, because it's actually quite clear both in terms of church law, but also in terms of church history. So Elizabeth Klein in Church Life Journal, which is Notre Dame puts it out, has an article called Early Christian Communion in the Hand. And she has in there numerous quotes showing from the writings of the early Christians themselves that in the earliest days that they received in the hand. And at the Last Supper, for instance, we don't find anything that would indicate the apostles are, you know, receiving on the tongue, for instance. So it's later in the life of the church that out of reverence in the West, we began to receive kneeling and on the tongue. In the East, they often will receive by intinction, where they dip the host in the chalice and either on a spoon or by hand, then you receive in the mouth. But these are liturgical practices that arose later. These aren't a thing where we can say anyone who does differently than I do is sinning or they're irreverent or anything like this. Is that clarifying or helpful at all, Teresa?
Oh, hang on, Teresa. I apologize. I put you on hold, and I forgot to take you off hold while Joe was talking. Go ahead. And is that helpful to you?
It's okay. That helped clarify. I just had the concern that at some point when my life is reviewed, I'm not hurting God by my actions. And
no,
that
following it's the beautiful
church,
that you care about that.
That also includes kneeling, too.
Yeah. So there's in the Liturgy of the Hours for, what diocesan priests and religious pray, and the laity are encouraged to pray this as well. In the Office of Readings for August 14th, for the Feast of St. Maximilian Kolbe, he talks about the beauty of obedience, that if there's something you're ordered to do under obedience that isn't directly sinful, then doing that thing, you'll never have that held against you. That when you are obeying what the church says to do, God is not going to say, you should have disobeyed the church. You should have done something different than the church told you to do. And so if the church permits you to receive in the hand or on the tongue, standing or kneeling, we don't have the permission to bind where the church has loosed. We can have a preference. We can have something we think is better. We can encourage our family in a particular way, but we can't, judge a fellow Christian for doing something the church gives them the right to do. And we don't need to live in fear that at our last judgment, we're going to be condemned for treating as loosed something the church explicitly loosens.
Okay. That's most helpful and a relief.
Good.
For what the sacrifice that has been made for us,
yes.
Is most reverent, most holy, and if I need to kneel, I'm more than happy to kneel, but just I appreciate the clarification.
God knows that desire to serve him, and that, I think, pleases him greatly.
I have to say, Teresa, one thing that I worry might not please him is those who go around placing heavy burdens on people that the church doesn't place on them. Like, you're trying to do the best that, to treat the Lord with the highest level of respect that you can. And there are people on the internet and with their podcasts or whatnot who will insist you must do things that the church does not insist on. And I think that those people have something to answer for. Those people should worry about standing in front of Jesus, because he has a lot to say about putting heavy burdens on other people. Does that help you, Teresa?
Also, it does. It also, different times, there's things that I don't think fully through. So for someone to say, just like if I was sitting receiving the Eucharist, well, that isn't as reverent as kneeling. Or if we are standing, the reverence is there that you're still praising God. But having that concept made me challenge what is the most pleasing to God. And so that's why I asked.
I'm glad you did.
Well, thank you, Teresa. Thanks very much. I'm sure many other people shared the exact same question. Davis is in Connecticut, listening on Catholic.com. Davis, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So my parents were raised prior to Vatican II, and they were told in school that Martin Luther was one of the most evil human beings who ever walked the face of the earth.
The good old days.
And I know that the Pope is a big fan of Martin Luther, and the Vatican has issued stamps for Martin Luther. I mean, I hate to use the cliche about the truth is somewhere in the middle, but, is all this appropriate, for someone who destroyed the unity of Christianity?
Ah, great question. Thank you.
That's a very good question. I would say I do think it is an exaggeration to call him one of the most evil men to ever exist. I think it's fair to say both, that he seemed to have a clear interest in following Christ and the teachings of Christ, and a clear problem with pride, with arrogance. I don't even think one needs to be Catholic to recognize that. I think a Protestant reading the writings of Martin Luther is confronted both with a man who seems like he's trying to follow Jesus and a man who is very prickly about anyone disagreeing with him and who says some very nasty things about those with whom he disagrees on basically anything and is often quite uncharitable. And I would even suggest that as he goes on, by all evidence, he gets worse and worse. He begins pretty supportive of the German peasants who are feeling oppressed. And then when they revolt, citing Luther as an authority, he argues that they should all be killed. I mean, he advocates everyone to kill them openly or secretly. He originally had a pretty tolerant view of the Jews, suggesting that the reason they hadn't converted to Christianity is because of the scandals in the Catholic Church. When they don't convert to Lutheranism, he suggests that their rabbis should be killed, their synagogues burnt down, and the Talmud destroyed. Like, he basically wants to outlaw Judaism entirely and also refuse them safe passage on the highway and everything else. So when you look at the career of Luther, his kind of theological trajectory, we don't find evidence of someone growing in holiness. We find someone who seems to have a genuine, impassioned desire to serve God. And then you can kind of see it get corrupted over time as he becomes more kind of embittered and disillusioned, maybe, with Christianity in general and the church in particular. I don't know. Different people are going to read Luther differently. He's a little enigmatic at times, but that's my own two cents in terms of how I read him.
And I'm going to leave it there and because we've got one more person on the line. I want to try to get that person on. Chris in Maryland. If you can be a bit quick with your question, Chris, I think Joe can get you an answer.
Hi, Si. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Chris.
What are the daily responsibilities of the Camerlingo, and how does their role change when the Pope dies from a leadership position in working with the College of Cardinals to elect the new Pope?
Oh, very nice. He is the one who helps to kind of facilitate the transition. He's the first one to be told when the Pope dies, and he's the one who makes the formal determination of death. He ensures that the Pope is, in fact, dead. He seals the papal apartments, and so he kind of begins the process for gathering the cardinals and organizing the conclave for the next Pope to be elected. I don't know what he does during the rest of the time. By that I mean Article 235, Section 1, says the Cardinal Camerlingo of the Holy Roman Church carries out the duties assigned to him by the special law governing the vacancy of the Apostolic See and the election of the Roman Pontiff. That's literally the first thing in terms of the description of what his roles are, is with the vacancy. So I don't know what he does when there isn't a papal interregnum. I imagine that he continues to do whatever his other roles are, which can kind of vary case by case. In the current case, it's Cardinal Farrell. And he is the head of the dicastery for the laity. And so he has the normal duties of a cardinal. He has this special set of duties in the event that the Pope should die.
All right, Chris.
That's great. And just very quickly, Joe, I had a chance to tell Si this. I met you in Prince Edward Island last month, so I just wanted to say thank you for the opportunity to meet you and to talk with you.
That's you, Chris.
Did we meet in the back of the church?
Yeah, in the church. Yeah, we did.
Yeah,
so it was a joy to meet you.
Thank you.
Chris, and you were very generous to us. I know, you want me to say this, but you were very generous to us in our recent pledge drive. So thank you very much for that help, Chris. That was very nice. It was just a chance meeting. We just happened to be there, and he was in there, and we had a very nice conversation. Joe, thank you for a very fine hour. I always enjoy working with you.
My pleasure.
You are one of my top five favorite Catholic Answers apologists.
Thanks.
You're very welcome. Check out Joe's work at shamelessjoe.com. It's a podcast. It's a YouTube channel. It's all of the above and new content at least twice a week. Check it out. shamelessjoe.com. That'll do it for us. But we'll do it again tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.